Hi everyone and welcome to episode 27 of the Stage Left podcast with Ezra Furman. We've got 90 minutes of Ezra being charming, charismatic, entertaining, reflective and unbelievably honest. It's a really great chat. Ezra, since recording the episode, has announced he's also playing Coachella later this year, and really nicely the BBC nominated him in the top 10 festival moments of last year on BBC's front page alongside the likes of Adele and Coldplay, which is really cool. Just a quick couple of thank yous before we start to Samuel and a few of the other people who've very kindly gone onto the Stage Left podcast website and actually bought us a coffee for our trouble. I work two jobs and I do this for free, and I also in my spare time try and make it as a musician. So, very kind of you to do that. And if anyone else wants to do that, you can do that at thestageleftpodcast.com. Also, thank you to Abby Herlihy, who is the wife of Sam Herlihy, who was on episode 25, who sent a really lovely message about how great it was to hear Sam talk so reflectively and in-depth about his music that he loves so much. Thank you for that message, Abby. It meant a lot. If you have any questions for us, please do get in touch at thestageleftpod on Twitter or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. All episodes featuring the likes of Tony Visconti discussing a lifetime's work, producing and recording David Bowie, including Black Star, which we actually recorded a few days before Bowie's passing, will be found at thestageleftpodcast.com. Other episodes with the likes of Billy Burnett talking about playing with Fleetwood Mac and Bob Dylan, Jennifer Batten, who was Michael Jackson's guitarist for a decade, that's really, really interesting, Elvis Presley's pianist Shane Keister, the Prodigy drummer, Kieran Pepper, and the likes of Aziz Ibrahim on what it's like playing with the Stone Roses, and loads more. The next episode is actually with someone else who appears in that top 10 list of the BBC recently. It's actually with John Waugh from the 1975, and we're going to be recording that in King's Cross in London just around the time they're over here to rehearse for the Brit Awards. So I'm going to be looking to release that around the same time for those who want to put that in the calendar. They're playing Madison Square Gardens. They've sold out Madison Square Gardens as well, which is pretty much a huge achievement for a band from Manchester, and that episode will also be available at thestageleftpodcast.com. Okay, we hope you enjoy this episode. Enough of me rambling on. Here's Ezra Furman. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. As regular listeners will know, we often speak to the musicians who are in close proximity when the magic is being made, but today we break the rules. Having discovered the music of today's guest over the past year, curiosity killed this cat, I'm afraid, and we were compelled to speak directly to the incredible voice and compelling lyricist that is the prolific and truly gifted songsmith that is Ezra Furman. Ezra's music has touched many people deeply over the past decade, firstly playing with the Harpoons, before going solo and earning critical acclaim with last year's album Perpetual Motion People, featuring the hit single Lousy Connection, which, given this interview is being conducted via Skype, may prove an almost overwhelming temptation not to reference. Since then, Ezra has put out the flawless EP Big Fugitive Life, which features Teddy I'm Ready, which was decided by the Stage Left team as our single of 2016 a few weeks back, and extraordinary live shows have seen Ezra described as the most compelling must-see live act right now by the Guardian. Today we'll be discussing Ezra's incredible voice, early life in Chicago, the composition of some of Ezra's best-known songs, what advice Ezra would give musicians entering the music industry, and how Ezra approached writing the remarkable closing track on the recent EP, set in Poland in 1944, entitled The Refugee. So what a pleasure it is to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Ezra Furman. Thanks for joining us today, Ezra. How's it going?
Oh, it's going well. I'm underslept and in a good mood.
That's cool. You're joining us from Chicago, is that right?
That's right. That's where I live, in Chicago.
Great city. It's a city that's close to my heart, and we're going to have a good chat about Chicago in a moment. I'd just like to begin, if I may, is that by stating this is the first episode of Stage Left that has been recorded since the passing of Leonard Cohen. And I know, Ezra, that in the past you've cited Leonard as an influence, and I wondered if you could share perhaps how his work made an imprint on you as an artist or songwriter.
Well, Leonard Cohen was a major one of the on the on the list of people that I got into when I was like 13 years old, when I started to care about music that wasn't punk rock. Because I had been just doing a year of binging on punk rock, and that was my only interest. And then I guess when I got a guitar, my parents were like, listen, we're going to get you an acoustic guitar, and you got to learn some folk songs. can't be all Green Day, you know? So that got me into some great songwriters, and Leonard Cohen was one of those. I was listening to Songs from a Room, his second album, all the time, and he stands out in particular for his, I guess, his kind of seriousness and his, like, I mean, for one thing, the quality of his writing is, like, kind of unparalleled. He might be the best at writing songs, like, that I know of. But that he showed that there could be some kind of holiness and dignity to it that wasn't, you know, seemed more commensurate with prayer than it did with, you know, pop/rock. And he started to be even more important to me because I someone got me a biography called I'm Your Man, which came out a few years ago, and I started to see all this stuff that we had in common, Leonard and I, being spiritual seekers, being like writerly songwriters, thinking about quitting music every 6 months. He seemed to be considering that, as I have often thought of in the past. I've sort of stopped thinking of quitting actively, but I just felt like I had a lot to learn from his life story, and I learned a lot from his life story. I'd like to be, he's like sort of a saintly kind of figure, not that he's so pure or anything, but that, like, it seems like he does all this different stuff, and he does poetry and prose and songs and religious seeking and meditation and stuff, and it all seems like it's part of one thing, one saintly project, which I'd like that to be true for me too. In the past, compartmentalized, like, my music life is over here and my inner life is over here, and I've got my spiritual life, and they should all be one thing, one effort to be real, to be for real. Which I think he seemed to pull that off. Long answer, huh?
That's a beautiful tribute, and a great artist, and thank you for speaking so honestly about that. Obviously, you've mentioned you're from Chicago, and you're recording that recording with us now in Chicago. It's a city steeped in musical heritage. Is that still evident everywhere you go today in Chicago, the musical heritage?
Oh, not really. It's not really that evident. You gotta go find it. I mean, there's, like, you can go to a good blues club.
Is that Kingston Mines? Kingston Mines? Is that one of them? Kingston Mines? Have you played there?
Yeah, Kingston Mines, yeah. And that place is also right across the street from a place called Blues, which tends to be cheaper, so that's where I've ended up. And I guess it's a little less famous. And then there's also just, I've learned where to look, like, for some really good bands that play old-fashioned kind of music. There's a lot of really good jazz. Right in my neighborhood, there's this place called the Green Mill, where it's an old place that's really famous. Al Capone used to go there. And there's just tends to be top-notch jazz bands playing till 4 a.m. there, and you know, it is evident if you look for it. I mean, that's the old stuff. I mean, hip hop is pretty evident. Like, you just hear, there's all these amazing Chicago rappers. Chance the Rapper, for instance, he's a favorite. I also like Kanye, and yeah, there's a lot of them. it's got a good pedigree, this town. And I whisper that I loved her in the ancient photo booth. She's just got one of those faces that demands the truth. And she likes Ted Hawkins too. And the truth is just a mole rat crawling underneath.
Your early life, Ezra, I wonder if you could paint a picture of growing up in... Did you grow up in Chicago as well?
Yeah, a suburb, mostly in a suburb right outside Chicago.
Cool. So a friend of mine who's a big fan of yours said to me that they wanted to find out what did living in a household with the little Ezra Furman running about look like for your family? What was growing up with an Ezra Furman in the household?
Well, there wasn't just me running around. There were four of us. So it was like on the crazier side, we were kind of wild kids and fought with each other often, but also like got along and played all kinds of imaginative games. All four, like me and my three siblings, are all creative people. Somehow we got on the let's be creative. I mean, our parents encouraged that, although they're not really. Well, my mom is a poet, but yeah, she's sort of part-time poet, and they're not particularly artsy people, my parents, but we became artsy kids somehow.
Where did that influence come from? When you say somehow, was that from your mother's poetry, or was it from an external source, or?
That's what I was just wondering while talking about that, because yeah, my parents are kind of surprised, perhaps alarmed, that we're all artists and we're all still doing art as a major part of our lives, all four of us. And they're like, we must have encouraged this, I guess, but I don't know. There was a lot of books around, a lot of scratch paper and pencils and markers, you know.
I know that your brother was, your younger brother was a musician as well, and often growing up, some siblings can drive each other in different directions, either bring them closer together, or actually further apart. How did his interest in music impact on you, and perhaps how did your music interest impact on he?
That's interesting. Well, so he's 4 years younger than I am. I think that he's kind... I don't know why. I think he started playing guitar because I had a guitar and I was playing guitar, and he was like, I guess I'm looking for role models and I'll do that. But it might be due to a personality difference or something, but we really, I just feel we play very different kinds of music and approach it quite differently. I mean, I can't say, I always feel like he just is more original than I am, and is musically, maybe that's not fair to say, maybe that's too strong, but like he's, especially musically, like I kind of do the simple chords that, you know, doesn't, nothing that's too complicated with chords or time signatures. And Jonah and his band Krill, like they are one of the musically strangest bands that I know of, and I like, it's amazing because they managed to both be the strangest and one of the best and most emotionally affecting. You know, they're not just like scientists of rhythm, and like some bands are like math rock, and that's usually not very emotionally potent. But they really pulled something off with Krill, which is now defunct, which is they're no longer making records or touring.
Which is a shame. And I know you've mentioned Green Day were an early influence on you, and Ezra, you and I are quite a similar age, and one of the first albums I ever bought was 1039 Smoothed Out Slappy Hours, but it was a bit it was a bit later when kind of Dookie and Insomniac came out that kind of it really landed with me. What impact did their music have on you growing up?
I just think I hadn't heard really punk at all, really. I guess I had heard some Nirvana songs, but I found a copy of Dookie, which my older brother had left laying around that he lost interest in, when I was 12 years old. So that was already 1998, I guess. And I think I was a anxious and hyperactive kid. I was an unpopular kid. I was very sad to be unpopular. I hadn't really realized that you could be proud to be unpopular and like screwing up, kind of, and you could actually wear it as a badge of honor that you don't fit into the system that you are asked to fit into. And it is, I mean, it's a simple idea, but I think it's very deep. It's very deep, and to not have to realize it for the first time is just like can be a game changer for some of us, you know. And it changed my life. And then I was like, oh, music is where this comes from, this feeling of validation. I mean, Green Day they're kind of a dumb band in a lot of ways, but like they are a band that's like, I know I'm messed up and like I'm gonna talk about it, and the band is gonna sound as anxious and like both like agitated, but really pretty joyful.
You kind of described Longview there. You know the song Longview. You pretty much described it there. What you know that off Dookie, like that is the summary of that song. What you've just described there, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, frustration, like, and I like good. I kind of started to think that the best music comes from frustration, or my favorite music comes from a kind of like frustration. And that's mostly the kind of music I've tried to make, is like music that is like trying to get beyond this frustration. You can feel it like almost trying to transcend that frustration, and then at the best moment it kind of breaks through and does. But it starts from a place of like struggle and like nothing's working out, what's wrong with me. I just love that. I think that's what it's for me. That's the number one thing that, I mean, that's always been my favorite thing. I'm getting into lots of things that music can do. I used to only be interested in that, but then I developed an interest later on in things like beauty. I watch your yellow windows. I couldn't see your face. I thought you'd always be my zero. I thought you'd always be my zero.
You grew up obviously playing acoustic solo gigs, I think, before forming a band. What were your main motivations around music at the time? Why did you want to be a musician? Was it for artistic reasons? Was it for other reasons? We ask that to most musicians who come on here, and they give quite a vast spectrum of answers to that question.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, I always wanted to write, and that's what I thought that I was going to do. When I was a kid, I was like good at writing, and I would write really long, wild stories, and I thought I was going to be like an author. And then when I realized that music actually can involve an act of like real writing, and it gives it to you so fast, you know? I mean, you hear music happen as, you know, in real time, and it doesn't take a long time to move you. It moves you right away if it's good. I was just like, that's my form. That's, I could do that. More than writing a book. I just wanted to cut to the chase. You know, why have the whole book there just to make you feel something three times in the course of reading it, when you could have a album and, you know, feel a lot 12 times.
And different narratives. So some of your songs have narratives within them. So you've kind of got your story. And because I know you wanted to be a fiction writer, I think you said in the past, growing up. And you kind of are doing that in a way in some of your songs.
In a way, yeah. I think it was also, it might have been also that I wanted to be honest. And to write fiction, like, I actually didn't want, I was kind of repressed, I would say. And still I'm kind of repressed. I'm just a shy person and have trouble talking to people, have trouble in social life. And that kind of thing tends to build up and then come out in a burst of creativity. And it's actually that writing songs and performing them was a quicker way to turn that valve and release the pressure of not being able to speak, not being able to tell the truth. It was just faster. It's just faster than writing a long thing for the page. I do still write prose, though, sometimes.
And do you use those as lyrics sometimes? Do you, when you're kind of looking for inspiration, are they lying about and you can kind of incorporate and weave them into some of your songs?
I do write lyrics without music a lot. And I've got a storehouse. I've always got a million things laying around. A lot of people are into music because we got short attention spans, and as human culture is going on, the attention span seems to be, like, it's not even the attention span getting shorter, we're like bored of the forms, you know? There's all these forms. There's like novels have been around since the 19th century, and I mean since way before that, but they like were kind of perfected in the 19th century, and like 100, 150 years on from that, people are just like, I don't need this anymore. I don't know. I mean, people still like novels, but like a lot of people are, they're writing memoirs instead. They're skipping the form and getting to the heart of the matter. Or they write really short things. I like that kind of stuff. Fracturing. There's a fracturing of the human mind going on over the course of centuries. And it produces these 3-4 minute pieces of writing that, to me, are the best art that's around. Like, music is the best art going, if you ask me. But it's also just what I like. It's to each her own.
To each their own. One particular song I'd like to ask you about is, you talked about your faith in the past and about Judaism. You said it's a way of thinking more than anything else that I think is entirely distinct. And the more you know of it, the more you can enter into that kind of thinking. Now, you touch upon your faith in a lot of your songs, but none more so than the incredible song on your new EP entitled The Refugee. I know you said that your grandfather only survived World War II as he left his hometown when feeling endangered. It's an incredibly moving song with very stark descriptive lyrics. What were your challenges composing that song compared to any other?
That was a song that actually I wrote as... I don't write so much poetry anymore. I used to write a lot more. But I started that one as a poem, and I finished it. And it was a poem for a long time before it became a song. But I found a way... I mean, I didn't keep the whole... all the words the same. I just rewrote it as a song. I think I could tell when writing that I was surprised that I was able to write about that. It's sort of a not very reality-based sort of morbid imagination of how people suffered, how my family suffered, or people who could have been my family.
April 4th, 1944. I recall my old address no more. I live day to day on the glossy dance floor of a wide countryside full of disappeared people. I sleep in the churches, eat grass like a goat. The calendar hangs on the wall of my memory. My name is inscribed up the sleeve of my coat. Here I am.
So my grandfather's story was always sort of obscure to me, and he wouldn't talk about it. He's been gone for 5 or 6 years, but he wouldn't talk about it. I remember trying to ask him when I was pretty young, like, what was your childhood like? And he just started crying. Like, he just started crying right away, and it was like, oh, we can't talk about that. And I don't think anyone really knew his story exactly. I know that he left home when he was like 5 or 6 years old and was in hiding for more than 10 years. I mean, he was in hiding for less than 10 years, but then he was in refugee camps. He never went home again. And he met my grandmother in a refugee camp of some kind in Europe, and then they came to America together, and it's like, well, let's just do our life now. And they're like 20 years old or something at that point, younger. And so, but because that story was vague to me, and never really explained or told, and no one really knows much about it. It has taken on these mythic proportions in my imagination, you know, so that I had all these dream-like images of it that come from nowhere, just like the stuff that your head makes up to fill things in. And to write well, I think with songs and poems, you have to allow things to mix together, all the stuff in your head, and it was not intended to be a faithful retelling of anything, but sort of to get at how it feels to have this story, this unknown story back in my family history, and what it does to hear what does it do to you to know that story or to have contact with that part of history? I think it changes you emotionally and politically.
what anxiety did you have any anxieties about kind of like the language to use and not to use when writing those that particular song, because it's such a sensitive subject and they're very stark lyrics and very descriptive, and was that an unusual challenge for that particular song? Did that take, I know you wrote it as a poem, but did you have any anxieties about it? Is it such a sensitive subject?
Yeah, it's like, how can I write about this? I didn't go through this, and there are people who have real trauma in the world, and it's sort of audacious to try to do, and in a sense kind of disrespectful, except I don't know. I mean, actually, that is why I had that song for a long time and didn't really release it. That one is older. We pretty much finished it in like back in 2012 or even 11. And it didn't come out till this year. And it was because I'm like afraid of that, but afraid of being called presumptuous or something, or talking of things I know not. At the same time, yeah, it was just increasingly on my mind, and there's a refugee crisis in the world, and like to be sitting on that song during a refugee crisis, it's just like, it just seemed worth exploring. It seemed worth allowing that out in the world.
I don't know if you know of a book, you may well do, and for listeners who don't, I'll fill them in, but a book by Primo Levi called If This Is a Man. It's kind of widely regarded as one of the most important pieces of literature ever written. And Primo was a Jewish-Italian chemist. And the book is about his story of surviving Auschwitz and the subsequent journey home in the immediate aftermath of his release, which incidentally was incredibly harrowing just in itself, let alone what happened prior at the camps. And I've not read that book for 7 or 8 years. And immediately the imagery you created took me straight back to that book. And I just felt compelled to say that I think the song is like a tremendous tribute to your heritage, and you should be really, really proud of it, because I think it's a very delicate subject that you pulled off brilliantly. And I just think, given the situation in the world right now, I think it was a good time to release it as well. So perhaps sitting on it for a while was a good thing. I think it's a song you should be really proud of. It's a beautiful piece of music.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say. I am proud of it. And I was afraid for my dad to hear it. Son of those refugees. And he said he really liked it. He said he was proud of me for writing it. So at least I didn't insult him.
How much does your parents, what your parents think of your music, land with you? Is it something? Are they people you want to rebel against in the nicest possible way, or do you want them to love your music?
Well, don't assume that we're on good terms. No, I'm on very good terms with my parents, and I do not care what they think about my music, though. I shouldn't say that. It's nice to have them say nice things about it. It's good. It's good when anyone does, but their voice is muted when it comes to me being creative, and that's what I do with anyone's voice is pretty much not a factor. You can't do anything if you're thinking about what someone thinks of it. I have enough natural stage fright kind of and nervousness and fear of my own that like it'd be too much to deal with if I cared about someone's opinion, like my parents. Like it's also, I mean, I'd compare them to the audience too, because like some people are like, oh, you know, shouldn't you think about what the people want, you know, or like give them what they want or something. And it's like, no, they don't know what they want until I tell them what it's, I don't know. It's a cocky thing to say, but like, I don't know. I believe it comes from me and what I'm interested in should not be filtered through anything.
Somewhere back there, I started drifting, and I just drifted all the way. Now am I still the man who paid for? Am I something completely different in the night and in the day? I was hideous and handsome, and I held for ransom. Yes, I was honest and I lied. That's my Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I know in the past you've described Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as a breakthrough in your songwriting. Why was that?
Yeah, why? Interesting question. I don't know. It felt like new territory. And I wrote that song, and I was still very much in the band, Ezra Furman and the Harpoons. And as diverse as we were a certain kind of band, you know. And that song was not the type of song we had done before. It was just in a different place, and I was in a different mood, a different life mood as a human being. And there are all these, they were, yeah, it was a turning point in my life also, because I moved into this house with these strangers who were like addicts and messed up people, kind of some of them. And anyway, they were having like all night parties, and you know, they'd get home at 4 a.m. and it was like this kind of dilapidated place. And I really loved living there. And I just felt like I broke down everything that I had in me. And it was all gone, and I could not be the same person anymore. I'd been like telling lies and getting just being quiet and shy just to get along so nobody would notice me, you know? And I started to feel I could not do that anymore, and I had to build my own world that was more true. I'm talking pretty vaguely, I suppose. But that mood, there's something about that mood of like, am I still the man you paid for? You know, I started to shed a self that had been created for an audience. And that was true for the audience of my band. It was even more true for the audience of like people I knew and just anyone I would see. I was kind of playing a role.
Was that a was that a liberating experience, or was that a difficult experience, or was it both?
Oh, both. Of course, both. Liberation doesn't come easy. And it's like a slow thing with a lot of different elements. I'm still dishonest, you know, and it's not something you get over. I just tend to try to make other people feel comfortable by not telling them the truth. And I keep working on that, trying to be truthful. I think a lot of the point of my career and of my life is to be truthful. The work that it takes to tell the truth, which is not everybody's thing, you know.
What is the truth?
There's a lot of great.
What is that truth you want to tell?
There's a lot of different truths to tell. There's a lot of truths to tell, I guess. Sorry, that was a ukulele that I just knocked over.
So I'll sample that.
There's a lot of truths to tell. I'm trying to be honest, you know, tell the truth about a lot of things. Who I am, what I think is important, what it's like to be, to do certain things or go through certain things, like tell my story for real.
One thing I wanted to ask was that you've in the past, I mean, these are quotes from you. You said, like, I was hiding these things, and you called yourself a liar, kind of rather harshly, as you just said there. Obviously, in relation to the things you've spoken about, your non-traditional gender identity, in your own words, you've also been quite disparaging in the past about some of your earlier material. And I wonder if the two were linked in your mind. Do you feel those songs perhaps were not fully realized because you felt in your own mind you weren't being as expressive as you might have been?
Oh, that's not how I would put it, really. I mean, I keep knocking things over. That's not how I would put it. As you get more mature, hopefully, you know, you get better at being a person as you go through life. I don't think I got better at being a songwriter and a musician and a performer and stuff. I did get better at all that stuff. And it was around the time I was like coming out more and telling more people I was bisexual and telling more people that, I mean, being dressing how I want to dress and all stuff like that. But that stuff just happened. One didn't cause the other. What caused them both is hitting bottom and reaching for, you know, realizing that this is my life, you know, my life's going by and I have to do better at everything. So, yeah.
One question I did want to ask is that you've, if we're happy to talk about it, you've obviously spoken very openly, and you do on your blog as well, about kind of mental health episodes you've had and periods of depression. A lot of your songs are very uplifting and positive, and most people probably dance to your music when your song comes on in nightclubs. They dance to it. Do you have to wait till those episodes have passed before writing those kind of songs? So what I'm really asking is your immediate output determined by your current state of mind?
You're asking if it's like passion recollected in tranquility, like Shelley or Keats defined poetry, I think. I mean, the truth is, like, if it's really bad, if I'm feeling really bad, I can't do anything, and I'm certainly not gonna be able to write a song. I think I have to be a little bit agitated or be on to something, some kind of deep feeling has to be in me at the moment that I write about it. But if I'm writing about depression, like, I did not, at least I didn't make, most of the progress of writing that song about depression was not made while depressed. And songs about anxiety do not get written while feeling incredibly anxious. I mean, people have asked me, actually a lot of people tend to ask me, like, do you think, like, you need to suffer to make art, you know? I think the best answer is, like, yes, you do, but you need to suffer just to be human, you know? And you don't need any more than normal. Like, the normal amount of suffering that everybody gets is way more than you need, you know? You can use some of that. If you somehow get a life where you don't have any suffering at all, then you can't be an artist, it's true. But everybody suffers, and you don't need to, like, stay sick if you're sick, you know? And that's really important to me because, yeah, you can romanticize losing your mind until you actually start to lose your mind, and then it's like, oh, this is not as fun as Syd Barrett made it seem before I did any research into his actual life.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's move on to advice to young musicians. So the first question I've got is, when you first started picking up a guitar, playing along to Dookie or Insomniac and playing those early songs and dreaming about becoming a musician, what's the reality like in comparison to how you thought the music industry would be, age 13 or 14?
Well, I just thought I couldn't do it. I just thought, and not even, like, it's still when I was, like, 18 or 19, I was like, I just didn't think I could do it, have that as my actual job, you know? I just thought it was a pipe dream that would not work out. Because I just thought it was like, it's one in a million to, like, become successful or famous. I thought you had to be, like, famous or else you, I don't know. It was just like, either you're famous and you're doing it and you're, like, in the Rolling Stones, or you're not, you know? And then you learn, like, with everything, it's like, you just have to work. It's just work, you know? And you can do it. You can figure out a way to do your dream. It's just going to be work. And you, and then I was into it enough to work really hard at it. And then I still, like, when I first started a band, I was like, well, if, you know, we'll know in a couple or 3 years if this is just totally not working out, and then we'll stop, you know, because that's how it, I just thought it can only take, like, an album or two to find success. But I was wrong about that, you know. It's just a slow gradient, and I guess really you learn quick. different people might learn at different speeds, I suppose. It actually took me a while to learn that, like, it's like, it's just work. You don't find someone who's like, I'm going to make you famous now. Somebody doesn't do that for you. You do it for yourself. That's what I've had to do anyway, you know. I was waiting for somebody. I was like wishing, like, when am I going to get that? Meet that person who, like, puts me on TV, and then it's like, now it's done, and now I'm famous, and et cetera. And it's like, that isn't how it goes. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's more like you work really hard for 9 years, and then somebody puts you on TV, and then you're on TV, and then a month later, that didn't change anything, and you're still just working your ass off. In terms of advice for aspiring musicians, just like, you got to be ready to work. There is no person who's going to come to you and make it easy for you. Probably. I mean, maybe that does happen for some people. I wouldn't count on it.
That's good advice. And next question about the music industry is, you obviously write your songs, and you're very kind of precious over them, and you piece them together. How do you find handing them over to a producer to perhaps rearrange or put different instruments on? Is that difficult? You're pulling a face at me now.
No. Well, I'm just trying. I haven't really done that in a long time.
Do you self-produce everything then? Do you do it yourself and work with a team of people, or?
Yeah, producer is kind of a bit of a vague term sometimes. And for me, like, we the band kind of figure out how to play it. If there are people who are not in the band playing on it, yeah, then that's an idea that I think of, and I have to find that person, call up a violin player, and that's, I make those decisions with my bandmate who is the best person to call the producer, Tim Sandusky, who plays sax and percussion in the band and tours with us. Has also recorded all of the music I've made since 2011.
Okay, how would you feel about handing over one of your songs to a producer, and he's like, okay, leave it with me, I'm going to put this together now and rearrange it and touch up bits, and how would you feel about that?
I couldn't be very hands-off about that. I would have to participate. I mean, with the Harpoons, we had producers that did more. Then, because we didn't know very much about how to do some of that stuff or make those decisions, but we were still like the band. We still decided what we would play, really. So I've never had any experience with a producer who's like, "I'm gonna make this into a thing now." I don't think there's that many. I guess there's probably a lot of people who do that. I've never worked with someone like that, and I don't think I could really just let them do whatever to it. Like, I tend to have very strong preferences about how my music sounds. I'm a little bit of a control freak, and I mean, put it this way, I was in a band that had my name in the name of the band as a Fremen in the Harpoons, and I felt the need to go solo and, yeah, be the only person in making the musical decisions pretty much. Then, of course, I formed the Boyfriends for touring, and then that became a band. But it is a different kind of, yeah, I'm pretty controlling about it.
You've got a truly incredible voice, and Honestly, your voice is absolutely amazing. I know you've, in the past you've talked about kind of having a bit of self-doubt about your voice, but seriously, man, I've known musicians who said to me it's the best voice I've heard in 25 years. There's one phrase, genuinely, there's one phrase in Teddy, I'm Ready, near the beginning where you sing, I'm going to make a big noise to the sky. And I wrote down what happens in that one phrase. And it's like, it's soulful, it's powerful, it shows great range. It effortlessly slips in and out of falsetto. There's vibrato, there's great diction, and we get a punky, gritty rasp, all in that one phrase. So what do you do to look after your voice?
Oh, God, nothing. I do not look after my voice.
Should you?
I met an opera singer on the train one time in Germany. And he spoke English. I think he was American. And we were like comparing notes from being, you know, live singers. And he was like, oh, so what do you do? What kind of exercises do you do for your voice? I was like, I don't, what do you mean? He's like, and he thought I was joking. I remember this very vividly. He was like, obviously you have to do exercises if you're a singer on stage. And I'm like, no, I don't ever. It was probably a bad idea. I don't know. Maybe I'm going to have some problem or have to get throat surgery or something sometime. I really do scream like unnecessarily. I like damage my voice almost on purpose. I'll catch myself like screaming at the top of my lungs while the band's playing and I'm not on the microphone. And like, there's no reason to just, it's just like, wanton destruction of my capacities. But then again, you know, people say all kinds of stuff about what you should and shouldn't do, and then you get somebody like Tom Waits, who has an amazing voice that is just like clearly damaged by alcohol and cigarettes, and it's, the damage is so gorgeous and fitting and perfect. So I saw, yeah, who knows, there's no, whatever I'm left with, no matter what happens to my voice, I'm going to make something out of it. I think I know how to do that, regardless of the notes I can hit.
Cool. You're totally into your live performances, they're known for being pretty wild. On a down night when you are, you know, things aren't going for you, or you're not really feeling it, or you're tired, whatever it might be, where do you go to internally to channel that energy to get going again?
Well, sometimes I go somewhere externally.
Ah.
One time in attack, I kind of got an attack of extreme depression and anxiety, maybe like 45 minutes before we were supposed to go on stage. And I mean, like, really bad, like, really bad. And so, and I just started walking. I didn't tell anyone where I was going. I just started walking. Well, I mean, it's kind of, I was going to just, like, walk until I died, you know? That was my plan. Somehow, you know, luckily my bandmate caught up with me and talked me through it for a while, but I, yeah, we went on stage probably an hour late or something, and it was very the answer to this question is ugly, you know? If it's really bad, like, if I can make it, it's probably just by being like, I know what the words are. I know from muscle memory how to play these things and how to go through it. And I know I can do that, just like a robot, you know? And luckily, that's pretty rare. I'm usually in a decent mood when it's time to play a show, because I really, really like playing shows. And it makes me happy to have one about to happen. Yeah.
Cool. And about a couple of other songs, Teddy Unready and Lousy Connection, two big hits of yours. What do you remember of recording or writing those songs?
Oh, it's all a blur, man. It's all a blur. I remember Lousy Connection was sort of a breakthrough for us. It was the first song from that album that we worked on, and the first one we finished most of. And it took, I don't know, it took some real care to come up with that arrangement. Some kind of like fractured version of an old soul song was intended, like, because I really like when a song changes a lot from what I thought it was going to be. And I kind of thought that song was going to, it started out, I was like trying to write like a Pavement song or something, kind of like alternative rock song. And then I changed almost all the words and changed the style and came up with this backup part. And, that was just a really fun one to do. And you got, but yeah, mostly to make those things, like, at least the way we did those, it was like obsessive, you know, and like just analyzing every little part of it, trying to find the perfect, yeah, just trying to make it kind of perfect for what it is. There's all these little good things, like on Teddy I'm Ready, there's this guitar that was basically broken in half. It's so old, it was like decay, like the strings were like 4 inches off the neck because it was starting to fold in half top to bottom. And we found a way to tune it to all the strings to the same note. And it's very fun. It's like it's being in a laboratory.
It's great. So there's two versions of Teddy I'm Ready, is that right? Because I listened to a second version. You look shocked.
Really?
Yeah, right. So there's this version that was on the EP, which I've listened to religiously over and over again. And the other day I found the single version, and in the left hand, the left earphone, there's this like mandolin kind of, or 12-string guitar extra part that's in there. And it sounds remastered as well. It's more punchy. It's a different two different versions, man. I promise you.
That's interesting. I think that guitar you're talking about is that broken guitar.
Right. It's really prominent. It's really prominent. And I've listened to the other version many, many times. It really stuck out. I was like, whoa, what's this? And then like kind of the bass drum and the snares kind of a bit more punchy. And I just wondered if you... That's why I asked about the producer, whether the record company are like, right, this is a catchy song, let's make a slightly more...
I know at some point they were like, oh, we're going to play this one on the radio, I guess, maybe. So, like, I know Tim made some kind of edited version of it, but I didn't think he changed... I was, like, kind of in on that. I don't think we really changed that much. Are you sure it's not the speakers that you heard it on a different... pair of speakers or something?
I'll check it out, but there was this part that was in my left ear that I was like, wow, man, I've listened to this song like 100 times. I've never heard that until I
weird stuff happens, you know. I mean, things get ripped differently to, you know, to vinyl versus there's probably a different MP3 mix than like the vinyl mix, you know.
Yeah,
which could be that, but I don't know, like a lot of different things happen. Things get mastered for different purposes. A lot of nuts and bolts.
Do you get much pressure from the record company around stuff like that? Because the reason I bring that up is you might know a British artist about 10 years ago called Damien Rice had quite a big song called Cannonball, which was just acoustic. And then his record company went, oh, we can make this really commercial. And they literally put on, like, it sounded like a Casio keyboard drum kit. That he had no, and it completely changed the song, and it became a really big hit. And he hated it, and he kind of wrote on his website saying, "I had nothing to do with this." What I know you're signed to Bella Union, I think, in the UK. What kind of Are you under any pressure or any steer or guidance to kind of do certain things from a record company point of view?
Well, first of all, I don't think Bella Union would ever do something like that. Like, they're very artist friendly, and I mean, you know, Simon Raymond, who runs the label, was in the Cocteau Twins. He's been in an indie rock band. Like, he knows, and like a kind of a weird one too. So like, I think he would be very hesitant to do something like that without the artist's permission. And they don't put that much pressure on me. And you know what? The thing is, I've had labels before that did put more pressure on me, and it doesn't really, I don't listen. I mean, like, I think one of my really strongest skills, which people don't know about, is the ability to say, no, shut up. I mean, not shut up, not be rude to anyone, but like, I know how this should be, and that's how it's gonna be. That's a hard won skill. And if, I mean, yeah, people give me like advice all the time, or and like people who really sort of know what they're talking about or potentially do are like, oh, your next record should be like this, you know, it really should. And this is when it should come out, and it should be, and if it's anything artistic, like an artistic decision, I just utterly ignore that their input. I mean, I got a vision. My problem is not knowing, I don't have a problem knowing what my music should be like. I have a problem like actually getting it to be that, you know, through the hard work of making it that way and writing it well and arranging it well and recording it well. Those are the challenges, but to have the vision, like, I got it. I got it. I know. I tend to know what I what to do. So I wouldn't listen if they did tell me.
That's a great answer. Thank you. And so the post-millennia celebrity obsession we've had has led to Donald Trump inexplicably becoming president of the United States 16 years later. We're recording this before his inauguration. How do you think he being president for the next 4 years will shape your output as an artist?
Well, this kind of question is like, it's always a question of how much do I give away about what I'm working on? Because, of course, there's always the chance that it'll end up totally different than what I say here. But I will say I've been writing a lot since well before Donald Trump was even nominated to run for president. I've been writing about dystopia and kind of like being on the run from authorities and a police state, things like that. I've just been writing about that already, and I was really hoping that it would just seem paranoid and irrelevant. But it does. There have been lots of movement toward authoritarianism that we see in Donald Trump, you know? And I'm disappointed to say that this record, these songs I'm working on might be more relevant than I hoped. They're still being formed, of course. How will it? Yeah, and then the other thing is, I guess as an artist, I already knew this, but it's sort of been reminding me that, you know, part of my job is to be on fire, like morally and culturally and spiritually and politically, and those things feel more important in a time of fear and loathing.
What's the feeling? I mean, we have listeners all over the world in many, many, many different countries, Ezra, and I'm sure, I mean, you know yourself, you have listeners all over the world as well. So the question I've got really is, like, I'm recording this from London, I've not been abroad since he has been elected. What is the, if you could sum up in a couple of words, what is the kind of vibe or feel when you walk around Chicago since then? Is it a mixture of, is it confusion? Is it disbelief? Is there people who are euphoric about it? It's such a strange one. What's the vibe when you walk around? Or is it no different? Or,
well, Chicago is a highly liberal town and a highly Democrat leaning town politically.
Yeah, I mean, so Barack Obama was the I mean, actually, when I mentioned I went to Kingston Mines, it was 2 days after Barack Obama got re-elected 4 years ago, and you kind of picked up on exactly what you're saying there. It's a very kind of liberal place, and so it must be a bit of a, I can't imagine that many Trump supporters would have been in Chicago, or am I wrong about that?
I have not encountered many at all in Chicago. In fact, I mean, and I seem to hang out in kind of liberal spaces. So I haven't talked to that many Trump supporters at all. And then, yeah, you find out someone you know is supports Trump, and it's like, oh my gosh, and what is that? I thought I knew that you were on my side or something. And there's a lot of, honestly, it's all starting to seem a little embarrassing, the way that liberals are like, oh my gosh, there's conservatives in this country, there are people who, you know, would support a racist person. It's like, yes, come on, how did we've been ignoring these people, as if, like, because television is written by liberals, basically we all the liberals are like, I guess we're basically a totally progressive culture. It's like, well, no, we are. There's a lot going on. There's more political and cultural diversity, I suppose, than some of us had counted on. I'm just concerned. I've the anger at voters has faded, sort of. I can still conjure it if I think about it, you know. I'm more just concerned for vulnerable people, really. That's what I'm worried about. I think that's the thing to remember, really, about Donald Trump. I think his presidency is going to hurt the most vulnerable people. And so I got to do more to stick up for vulnerable people. I think a lot of people are feeling that. A lot of people are suddenly more political, you know, and not just more political, but more activist and more charitable. And like, yeah, I have to volunteer at this homeless shelter or whatever. That's what people are saying. That's what I'm getting, a lot of that from people, of like, got to do something. But yeah, maybe that's just my, like, adult friends. I think a lot of young people are like, well, the world's fucked, so let's make some more jokes on Twitter. And it's like, oh man, let's, you see where that got us.
Thank you for answering that. Thank you for answering that so honestly. And yeah, my day job away from here is as a volunteer coordinator in London. So if you ever want to do any volunteering next time you're in London, I'll put you there. I'll put you in touch.
That's an interesting question. Maybe I'll send you an email.
Okay, cool. One question. I know you do loads of different covers. Crown of Love, Arcade Fire. Probably my favourite Arcade Fire song, and it's quite an unknown. And it's on their first album. Wasn't released as a single, so. Great choice right. On that. Why did you pick that particular song?
Well, yeah, that was always one of my favorites of theirs. But also, it's like it's a doo-wop song, you know? It's basically, even in like the word choice, a lot of it is very... like just classic romantic doo-wop kind of stuff, and they the arrangement that they did is not very, you know, it's Arcade Fire, it sounds like them, but it's a waltz with those chords, and it's like I love that kind of music, and I just, that is such a good song. It seems to have a lot in common with some things I've tried to write, which are like intended to be very influenced by like doo-wop soul and early rock and roll, with lyrics that you wouldn't find in those old songs. So that kind of is what that song is like. It's like a old doo-wop song that talks about cancer and praying for rain and stuff.
There's one particular line which is, I carved your name across my eyelids, and for 10 years, I've been trying to work out exactly what the meaning is behind that. What was your interpretation?
I mean, it's a desperate love song, and it's a breakup song, and it, you know, when somebody means so much to you, and then hurts you, you are marked by them, you know, and you've got their name, and it feels like every time you close your eyes, you're gonna see them. So like that, I think that's what's going on there. It's also just good, like it's a good brutal image, you know. Yeah. It's just visceral. Desperateness of that song. It's one of the reasons it's my favorite. One of my favorites of theirs is that it is. He's just so desperate. You've got to be the way. Your name is the only word I could say. It's so good. That's such a good line. It gets me. I think it's. People forget maybe about the Arcade Fire that they wrote some old fashioned kind of songs, even though, you know, they have these numbered names and they have like a whole aesthetic of very contemporary aesthetic. Like most good songwriters, there's a lot of debt to old mid-20th century music.
Have you seen them live?
No.
Really? Oh, wow, man, you got to see them live. They're absolutely amazing.
I guess I probably should. As one of those bands I should really see live. I I never saw like the White Stripes. And I still can't believe I didn't see them. I just can't believe it. I mean, I think they will reunite at some point, but we'll see.
Cool.
I'm still kicking myself about the White Stripes. best band of the 2000s.
Yeah, great band. And okay, so we'll begin to wrap up because I know we've taken a lot of your time, and thank you for that. Couple of last questions. What specific ambitions do you still have left to fulfill as a musician?
I want to make the greatest record ever made. That is my fondest ambition, and it's an absurd thing to say. I think I'm just absurdly ambitious, but I really want to make an album that is better than any album that has ever existed. I don't particularly expect that I can do that, but I think it's a tenet of faith for me that I should try, that I could keep trying. And that's a way that's likely to cause me to make things that are of a very high quality. I have some other, you know, potentially more achievable ambitions, and I'm thinking a lot in this time. It's sort of most of the touring for the last releases has ended, and we are beginning to work on new things and think about when they'll come out and what we'll do. And I do want to change. I want to do something different as a live performer. And I think it's really too soon to be helpful about what that might be. I mean, I have, it's coming together in my mind, but I shouldn't say anything about it yet.
Fair enough. How will Ezra Furman in 30 years from now reflect on this specific period of your career?
Here's what I hope. I'll be like, man, I am so much better now than I was then. That's what I hope I'll say in 30 years. Because I just want to, I believe in the arc of the artist that just keeps getting better. And I guess it's not, that's sort of rare maybe. But I definitely know there's a lot of artists who are like that. I know that I get better at doing this. I get better as a writer and a musician every year. I just hope that continues to happen.
I have this theory that in 15 years you'll sound like what Rufus Wainwright sounds like now, and you sound like what Rufus Wainwright would have sounded like in his 20s, really excitable and really young and kind of fresh. We'll see how that plays out. What's your plans for next year, Ezra?
2017, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm planning to make the greatest record ever made. I don't know when it'll come out. It takes some time. It takes some time to be ambitious. But I don't know if it'll come out in 2017 even. So I'm going to work on that a lot. I'm also going to, I have a lot of life plans that maybe aren't, well, not a lot of life plans, but like, I'm not only trying to get better at doing music, I guess is one way to put it. trying to get better at a number of things. And I'm, yeah, I mean, I'm learning about spiritual truths and how to be a person who, is a reminder of the presence of God in the world, which I think is my other biggest ambition, is to remind everyone around me, of the holiness of life, I suppose, the sacredness of it, the transcendence that's available to us at all times if we reach out for it. So that's my other plan for the coming year.
I know you're influenced by Robert Johnson, who it was famously claimed as a bit of a myth that he met the devil at the crossroads to sell his soul in exchange for his guitar prowess. What would you sell your soul for?
Wow. That's a hard question, my friend. Because the obvious and true answer is my soul's not for sale. And yet, I could really go for a grilled cheese sandwich with mustard and tomato right now. So, that's the human condition, perhaps. I have great desire. I have insane, overwhelming desire for things that are probably not as valuable in the end as my soul is. But for now, I mean, you could get it. Maybe we could work out an installment plan.
I'll let you think about it for next time. Okay, so we'll begin to wrap up there. Thank you for appearing on the Stage Left podcast, Ezra. I hope you've enjoyed it. Look after that truly exceptional voice of yours. Keep being prolific. Keep up the spellbinding live shows. And we look forward to your even greater ascent into the consciousness of the music world in the coming years.
Oh, thank you. I can try to keep more left on the stage, if that helps, like, make this appearance on your podcast more legitimate. I can be position myself over to the left a little more.
Next time you play in London, that'd be really good, because I'm getting a bit of stick for it at the moment. But that's cool. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, this was a pleasure. It was fun to linger. Did great.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's very kind. And thank you for being so candid with your answers as well.
I can't help it.
For more episodes featuring musicians who work closely with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Otis Redding, David Bowie, Oasis, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, and many, many more, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, and we've now got an Instagram page. Go and have a look at that as well. There's lots of plenty nice stuff in there. We'll see you at the end of next month, which will be February, with John Waugh from the 1975. See you then.